Everywhere in this building you are compulsorily recorded. Your consent to be recorded in classrooms has been unlawfully presumed. The law school is busy racking up a very high number of damages for privacy invasion, which one of these days I and maybe one of you or two of you in the room will go and collect from them by lawsuit. We do not here spy on you. What you say is never recorded, or rather, if it is accidentally recorded, I remove it before I publish the audio. The microphones in here don't work. Please don't assume they do. If they mysteriously start working, I will rip them out of the wall and throw them in the trash. We are trying to remember what it was like to learn before the parasite. We are trying to remember what it was when we paid attention, when we spoke to one another, when there were no secret police listening, when there was no effort to make you externally responsible in any way for how you think or what you say or what we discuss here. The same applies, of course, to our reading and writing. Every time you use the university single sign-on system, you are logged and monitored. Canvas, which is around here called CourseWorks, a student surveillance system with a side hustle in curricular delivery. Thank you, Theo. You don't have to actually mouth the words as I am speaking them. But you know that during the Second World War, Laurence Olivier gave a command performance of Henry V, much like the hyper-patriotic Henry V that was put on film. And the Prime Minister, that cigar-smoking Republican Winston Churchill, showed up to the performance. And Olivier says in his memoirs that Churchill sat in the front row, and in order to prove how well he knew the play, he recited every line just a beat ahead of Olivier himself. If you're going for it, I will let you, I promise, but you don't have to. Yes, a side hustle in curricular delivery. That is to say, the purpose of Canvas is to surveil your learning. That's its actual purpose. In order to do that, of course, it has to deliver some curriculum to you, but its primary job is to store and remember and analyze your behavior as a learner. My colleagues are mostly obtuse about this. They don't know exactly what is happening, and so you can't blame them, but you ought to blame somebody. Because watching what people read and assessing how long it takes for them to read it and what they do next after reading it and how what they read affects other behavior going on in their mind or at least in their smart-ass phone at the same time is a vicious and totalitarian behavior. If law school had been like that when I arrived, I would have left. But that was so long ago that it wasn't possible yet. What is being done to you is what is possible. We are, in this course, going to assess one aspect of what it means that what is being done to you is what is possible, namely the aspect which concerns state power. For those of you who weren't along in the first part of this ride in the fall term, this is a pair of offerings which I allow or negligently reproduce in the form of the public-private distinction, which if you are now, as you all are sophisticated law students, you know is total crap to start with, but we divide things into public and private law. To the extent that that division ever made any sense, the thing that some of you rode through law in the Internet society is the private law side. I worry there about the consequences in civil society between concentrated economic power and individuals and between parties conducting competition in the marketplace or trying to do something other than to conduct competition in the marketplace, what the changes in technology and the according changes in society have done. Here we worry about the other part. What has happened in the relationship between citizens, individuals, and public power, government primarily, which means, of course, in this context, the spies, the torturers, the congresspeople, the administrators, all the various entities that we might conceivably want to put within limits with respect to the use of the power of the state against individuals, a set of limitations which we refer to as constitutional rights. And so for the purpose of understanding what has happened in human society to the relation between the individual and the state, it would of course make sense to focus on constitutional regime. I will in this room be talking in terms of reference set by the United States Constitution, by the particular forms in which, through language and history and context, we can interpret what has happened to our constitutional rights in the course of the transformation to this particular digital society we live in. But all of those matters are, of course, denationalized to some significant extent. The net everywhere behaves either the way free people would want it to or the way the Chinese Communist Party would want it to. Power is either perfecting totalitarianism in the world or it is not. Where that particularly happens to be going on, where the routers are, where the smart-ass phones are, where your vulnerable eyeballs and eardrums are, is not arbitrary. You choose to be here, maybe because you think here you have some constitutional rights, or just because it's convenient. And we will talk as though we were here most of the time, but we are, of course, not just here. We're everywhere. And you will scatter to the world, and everywhere you go, some things that usen't to be true will be true, and everybody around you will be comprehensively surveilled in a way that even when I lived in the Soviet Union, nobody around me was comprehensively surveilled. And your freedoms will be at all times on a knife edge of a kind that they were not once upon a time in the world in which I grew up. And we will try and figure out whether there is anything about the idea of constitutional restraint on government power which could deliver back to you a world one fraction as free as the world into which I was born. That's the basic principle purpose of what we are doing here. Now, because this is a law school course and procedure makes substance, or if it doesn't, at least civil procedure teachers have to pretend that it does, I need to talk procedure before we can begin talking substance. And of course, in law school, all procedure is ultimately about grades. So I have to talk about grades first, because we must talk about the most important things first. Those are the rules. There is no exam in this course. Exams are stupid. It's ridiculous that they are ever given in law school. It should never happen again. It happens all the time for reasons I have no understanding of. It's been 29 years since I last gave an examination. I don't propose to start again during the remainder of my lifetime. We will instead write and read and edit and think about it. You've been in law school long enough now to understand that the single most important skill that you have as a lawyer with a literate device in your hand is the skill of editing yourself. That's not taught anywhere in law school. Most of the time, if you have an editor in law school, that editor is another child working with you on some magazine that publishes unrefereed so-called scholarship by people too important to be subjected to the ritual of rejection. And editing in that sense is not done by faculty either. As you know, if you have essayed the so-called major writing project and have received back a draft that says, pretty good, B+, or yeah, sort of, or whatever. But editing is, after all, what is really the heart of lawyers' work, because nothing is ever handed in on the first draft, and nothing ever should be handed in on the first draft. Getting from the first draft to better is what legal writing really is about, and it would be good if law school did more of it, but law school instead, as you are aware, gives exams. We will write two essays. Each draft of each essay, not more than 1,000 words. If you give me 1,001 words, you might have just spared the trouble altogether. It does not exist. 1,000 words is a good length. The first thing about 1,000 words is there is no room for bullshit in it. You must not even consider trying to put any bullshit in 1,000 words. It will just lie there and stink. On the other hand, if you know how to write 1,000 words, if you know how to put a single idea coherently and effectively with punch and persuasive power in 1,000 words, then you can make any other thing that a lawyer ever needs to write from units of 1,000 words. Your briefs, your, oh God, scholarship, whatever it is, it will turn out that it was sufficient to understand how to make every 1,000 words absolutely count. And so we will try. Always at least 2 drafts. You can, of course, if you wish to try, get the first draft made by ChatGPT. It won't work well, but you can try. But how are you going to get it to do the revision? The thinking, which the software cannot do, is what takes the bad first draft and makes it a good first draft. I have asked you to read the evaluation policy. You should read carefully the evaluation policy in every law school. Oh, but you can't, because there isn't any. The principle of explaining to you how your learning is going or how it went in any sophisticated or accountable way is ignored around here. There are no evaluation policies, but you should read mine because it exists and because I use it. Just to hit the highlights of a document you have to read for yourself, there are 3 things being measured in the measurement or evaluation of your learning here: effort, commitment, and improvement. I don't need to say much about effort. Diligence is always lying there on the surface to be seen or not seen. I have run a training practice for young lawyers in this area in which I work, called the Software Freedom Law Center, for just short of 20 years. It has never been difficult for me as a supervisor at any given moment to know whether people were working diligently or not. That's simple. So effort, you either make it or you don't, and it's apparent. Commitment in this sense means the degree to which you take seriously the topics you have chosen, the questions you have asked, the parts of the material or the nature of your thought stream that you care about, right? Because you always choose the topics of your writing. In any significant intellectual activity, it's the quality of the questions which matters more than anything else, as you well know. And it's not up to me to ask your questions, it's up to you to ask your questions. Commitment, then, is a measurement of how actually determined you were to get to the bottom of whatever question it was you wanted to ask. And from an editorial point of view, judging commitment is not that difficult. But improvement, now that's what really matters. In a numerical sense, if I am to combine those different measurements of effort and commitment and improvement to get a score which is ranked, which ultimately becomes this obscenity called a grade, it will be true that my weighting algorithm, that is a little arithmetic, you know, a multiplication and an addition, it's an algorithm, the multiplication will be to give a heavier weight to improvement than to the other 2 components. Improvement matters more. Well, of course it does. We're trying to learn. Improvement is measured against changes from one draft to another and changes from the first to the second essay. There's plenty of improvement to find. Your acute strategic intelligences will just have reminded you, as you noticed when you were reading the evaluation policy in the first place, that if improvement is what really counts, then you should always begin by turning in an abysmally bad first draft, right? All your careful game theoretic approach to law school says that you should win by submitting a terrible, terrible first draft and thus gaining enormous points by improving it. So I dare you. Because, of course, psychically you are unable to submit a bad first draft, at least not what you think is a bad first draft, because your educational experience throughout your life has been based upon the proposition that you must not ever fail at anything, which is part of the reason that creativity has been so difficult for you to maintain as you went through your long educational experience. Without failure, nothing gets created. Without a willingness to make a bad first draft, nothing is ever written, because you can either make a bad first draft, or you must wait until you have an excellent first draft, at which point there are a lot of things you should have written in life that you will never have written at all. So here is the opportunity. You are being rewarded, incentivized, as they say in law school, to produce bad first drafts, which I assure you, you will do. You just won't think you have done it. So try, affirmatively. Find a good question you don't know how to answer and write a really bad first draft. And from there, ad astra per aspera. Questions about how to succeed in this course while really trying? No? Good. All right, well then we're almost done with procedure. The way in which this works is that I will offer a moment when it would be good for the first draft of the first essay to be written. I'm not going to say 3 weeks ahead, because then you'll spend 3 weeks on it and it won't be bad, it will just be awful. But 10 days or so, and then we'll read them and we'll mark them up in the wiki. You have a choice, of course, in the wiki. You can mark anything you write to be seen only by you and me. You can mark anything you write to be seen only by the people who are registered in the wiki for this course, or you can write something that the rest of the world might actually find useful. I will comment, and we will discuss, and anybody else, if it is a public document or a document available to the class, can also chime in. We will do whatever it is to try and make from draft to draft a better draft. My job, after all, is to ensure your success, not to determine your failure. Oh, I can't possibly have said that. Law school is for the purpose of determining your failure, never for the purpose of encouraging your success. But that's how we're going to work it, if we possibly can. Revisions will be on whatever schedule it is that you like. Those planning to get out of law school or to do something else will probably want to finish their revisions by the due date at the end of the term. If you send me some email and say you want an extension, you get an extension. I don't mind. It doesn't matter to me. We review, we revise, we consider. If you want to do a third draft or a fourth or a fifth, that's fine with me. The only thing is that after you have gotten a grade, you'll never touch any of it again, because all your incentive will have gone away. And therefore, we should work together while we can before the beautiful system of academic evaluation totally demoralizes, or at least demotivates you, and you want to move on to something else and never have to deal with it again. So let's use the time we have. As we go along, I suspect we will find, because the Supreme Court is sitting and various bad things are going on in the world around us, that the situation in which we live is becoming more rather than less desperate. But I will start by making it as desperate as I can, and we will work our way outward from there. Any more questions about housekeeping, how we do what we do before we come to what we do? All right. At risk of repetition for the few people here who have been listening to this for the past 14 weeks, then let me start with a set of basic assertions, which in the long run we will see whether you come to agree with me about or feel differently about. In the course of the last 20 years, most definitively in the last 10 or so, we have created a new form of human existence. We have built an extraskeletal nervous system which increasingly embraces the entire human species, turning us from a collection of individual organisms into a tightly bound form of social animal, more tightly bound than we have been at any time in the last 5 million years since we and our chimp and equivalent primate cousins went our separate biological ways. We are becoming closer to an anthill than we have ever been. a system which unifies our nervous systems into the general overarching anatomy that we now call the net or the internet, if we're being long about it, but which is fundamentally transformative of the nature of the human being. That nervous system's anatomy is the structure of the network itself, how the network is built, the pipes and switches of which it is composed, which I will talk about next week as little additional tedium for those who have been through the first half as I can. But for the moment, let us simply say that we built a nervous system. We designed it for the purpose of unifying human communications in a way which would be resistant to disruption by nuclear war, an actual design objective of the thing we made, and which we built in such a fashion as to make it at least theoretically possible for power to know everything that every human being does. The design of that nervous system was not originally built for the defense of human autonomy or privacy. It was built, as I say, in substantial measure to allow the survivability of nuclear command and control. And the irony is that a system made by state power for the deepest and potentially most destructive of human uses has become the actual nervous system of humanity's future, with a number of deep and powerful vulnerabilities built in. The physiology of that nervous system, not how it is architected, but how it operates, the physiology of that nervous system is determined by software, computer programs, running in general purpose computers of one sort or another, acting as switches, control points, differentiation and distribution points in that nervous system, like nodes in your own net inside your body. The software that controls the operation of that nervous system increasingly, therefore, controls how human beings are, how they feel, how they act, how their wishes are generated and executed, how power impinges upon them, how they are arrested, tortured, and destroyed. Physiology makes all of that happen now, because the happenings in human society, whether they are centered on the state or they are centered on the market or they are centered on whichever mysterious thing it is that isn't either the market or the state and which law school therefore doesn't know about, the way in which that power is concentrated is at this level of analysis epiphenomenal. What is important is that software does it. That the behavior of the nervous system, which is technical, becomes over time the behavior of the people, which is social, and the nature of humanity, which is, I don't know, important, trivial, barely attainable, whatever. The anatomy and the physiology of the network we have made, the nervous system now producing the superorganism called humanity, and which is altering in no subtle way the behavior of each of the individual organisms that comprise that superorganic cluster. The nature of that nervous system's physiology has been modified from what it might have been, from what it could have been, from many of the ways in which software could operate that network, through the presence of another quasi-biological entity. Like the nervous system itself, that quasi-biological entity is not made of cells with DNA inside them, not produced by the chemical reactions catalyzed by the various enzymes that over the last 4 billion years we have been cooking up together. But like an organic biological system, that system of the network is subject to parasitization. And our nervous system, the nervous system that is the future of humanity, this shared network upon which we are now dependent and in the midst of which we live, has fallen to an infection, a parasite made of software. The parasite, which perfuses this network now, so deeply that each and every one of you depends entirely in life upon devices which are themselves heavily loaded with the parasitic virus. The parasite has a particular functional and metabolic structure, as parasitic organisms do. It eats behavior. It metabolizes human behavior. It acquires human behavior, and it produces stimuli that cause more human behavior. And it absorbs the behavior that it stimulates. You take for granted that this is the way the software that you use in the net behaves, that it is trying to attract your attention, that it is trying to make you click and swipe and buy and fuck and do all the other things it wants you to do, and to keep you entrained in the network, because you can't buy or sell or learn or talk or fuck without interrelating with the intermediary, which is some software in the way. And that software, which could be any kind of software and which could do anything that software can do, which is everything that computers can do, which soon is everything that human beings can do, that software has been engineered, has converged on a design which wants to establish a parasitic environment in which your behavior is modified to create more behavior beneficial to the parasite. If you had rabies, which thank God you don't, it would behave the same way. The rabies virus would enter your nervous system and it would begin to modify your behavior. The purpose of that behavior modification would be to cause you to bite things. Because in biting things, your saliva would spread the virus from one organism to another. The same thing happens here, except that in the end, of course, unlike the rabies virus, it doesn't kill you. It reduces your disposable income. At the back of this virus, of course, is an alliance with capitalism. I don't need to say anything very much about that. You all know capitalism very well. But simply that the purpose of the virus is to grow without limit, as the purpose of all capitalist entities is to grow without limit, and to incorporate more and more human behavior. It has now a substantial fraction of all human life, and it will have all human life in one more generation, locked into that cycle of behaving for the behavior-collecting parasite, which metabolizes human behavior and produces stimulus and, as a byproduct, money with which to get its human allies to spread it further. We're not here to think about all that. If you wanted that, you should have taken it last semester when there was more air in the room. But I need now to point out about the parasite that it has a peculiar relation to human mental life. Thanks to this, without which you are largely likely to believe that you would perish, this, the neuron that connects you to the parasite, this thing, the smart-ass phone, is the densest collection of sensors ever assembled by human beings, gram for gram. We have stuff in orbit which is even more censorious than your smart-ass phone. We can put a thing in orbit that will be able to take a picture of a golf ball resting on a lawn 5,000 miles below and take a good photograph of the brand of golf ball. But those things weigh a whole lot more than your smart-ass phone does. Gram for gram, your smart-ass phone is the densest collection of sensors ever assembled by human beings, which is why the battery in the smart-ass phone, gram for gram, produces more electrical energy than a nuclear reactor does. Which is why if the engineers screw up and they make the battery container not quite rigid enough and you bend the battery a little bit while you are sitting on the smart-ass phone on your ass on the airplane, suddenly you have a burning smart-ass phone in your back pocket and Samsung loses a lot of money. Because it's all pretty dangerous stuff. But it's meant to appear to you that it's a really good idea for you to carry around the spy satellite connected to a nuclear reactor in your pocket for the purpose of spying on you, which you do all the time, greatly assiduously. You don't go from room to room without it. You never leave home without it. You would never think of doing any of the things that you do, learning, buying, fucking, without the phone. So that neuron, that connection between the nervous system infected by the parasite and the nervous system you still maintain, and which you quaintly think of as the location of you, that object acquires for the parasite to which it is connected a unique view of human activity. Its specificity is astounding. The smart-ass phone and the little bits and bobs that surround it, like your Nest thermostat, and they know about you everything. Oh, that front-facing camera, that facing you camera, the one that has to exist. You can't call a smart-ass phone an Android object if it doesn't have a you-facing camera. The trademark is not available unless the thing actually looks at you. That you-facing camera in the smart-ass phone, it knows how fast your heart is beating. Even if you're wearing darker and better camouflage than I am or than pinkish people like me are, every time your heart beats and forces blood in your veins, it changes subtly the color of your face. And the smart-ass phone you-facing camera knows that. It can take your pulse. It has motion detectors and inertial objects. It knows how fast you walk. It knows how fast you got out of bed. It knows how long your shower was. With the Nest thermostat, it knows how many times you flushed the toilet. It knows how much you drank if you have an Android refrigerator in between the times you pissed. You are well understood by it at the individual level. No sparrow falls without the parasite being informed. But at the same time that system of surveillance with which you have voluntarily surrounded yourself, which you care and feed and power and pay for and buy extended warranty protection on, at the same time that the parasite through that organism's organ, that object, that piece that you wear, that behaviorally implanted spy device, at the same time that it knows everything about you in detail, its backhaul knows everything about the entire human race, collecting trillions of data points a day from billions of people across human societies, throughout the human race, and therefore also acquires an awareness of the largest, most general truths emerging from the broad human population. It sees both the fall of every sparrow and the largest statistical emergent truths of what it means at any given moment to be a human being anywhere inside the human race. It sees both from the smallest to the largest in a comprehensive way. These actual entities we are, we have never possessed the ability to know light. And when the human race has thought, as it occasionally did, about what it would mean to be able to see like that, from the smallest of everything to the largest of eternal truths, well, if we called it anything at all, we called that way of knowing the mind of God. And so the truth of the matter is that you now live in a species-wide nervous system we call the net, organized as it might have been in many different human ways, organized in fact now to maintain an infection across the entire species by the parasite with the mind of God. Here we are. as my friend Dan Gere, one of the engineers who with Vince Cerf and the others built the thing we called the ARPANET that became the internet in the mid-1970s. As Dan said in a talk in 2012, just a little bit before the Snowden era began, to a bunch of information science professionals in Silicon Valley, Dan said, this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. He was right about that. That's the motto of now. You are the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. So the purpose of this inquiry is to discover what that choice is, how it is made, what its consequences are, what happens if you try to choose by not choosing, which is how you and almost all the people around you presently live, by not choosing, by not thinking of it as the choice, by not thinking of yourselves as the last human beings who have it, and therefore, your children won't. Now, among the characteristics of our life in the network of human beings parasitized by the parasite with the mind of God, state power is indeed the likeliest to seem ultimately dispositive to us, because the state possesses, as Max Weber and others first pointed out, the exclusive power of the use of violence within a territory. It's actually Vladimirian, but it doesn't really matter. So that exclusive appeal to violence by the state, if you leave aside, say, I don't know, Donald John Trump or something, but the assumed monopoly of violence by the state is, of course, why, if we think about the human race making the choice wrong, if we think about life a generation from now inside a society organized around the form of collective nervous system that we presently are living in, that you in particular are solicitously carrying about with you everywhere you go, if we think about the worst that can happen, we might then think of it as the state will take on the power of the parasite, and it will use the power of the parasite to eliminate the very idea of freedom. That's a terrible nightmare to have. It is, unfortunately, the actual governing principle and intention of the Chinese Communist Party. That is the official doctrine, the intentional statement of the plan for the human future. And in this respect, the Chinese Communist Party, as we will see recurrently during the term, is not actually innovating. It is merely being more clear than everybody else. Like that Donald John Trump I was mentioning, it likes saying the quiet part out loud. But power and the parasite have begun to merge. State power has begun to find its way towards an absolute commensality with the parasite's possibilities. And as it does so, well, you go to Columbia Law School, you are spied on everywhere, you are recorded everywhere, you are tracked everywhere, you are monitored everywhere. Does anybody know how many video cameras are looking at you inside this building? Jerome Green Hall, this temple of justice? You don't. I don't either, because I don't know which of them is broken. But if they are all functioning today, and almost nothing in this building functions every single day, as you are aware, but if they're all functioning, there are 82 of them. 82 of them. All of the bits intercepted by those cameras, all pictures of you, everywhere you go, go directly to the police. I mean the university police, but it doesn't really matter. It's police. It's not us. We have no control over those feeds. We have no visibility into those feeds. You are on police camera all the time. And my colleagues and I now practice law inside a law practice pervasively subject to police surveillance. You would think that this is a moronic thing to do, and indeed it is. But what can I say? They're my colleagues. My partners. It's our law practice together, and this is how we do it, and this is how you participate in it. The day that the state decides to take those bits, Well, you will have no fucking recourse and you won't know that it occurred. And that is happening to you all the time, and you are letting it. I mean, you are letting it, you understand. If each of you decided today to write one sentence on one side of one sheet of paper, which says, I, give your name, hereby withdraw all permission to surveil, record, or otherwise interfere with my privacy and my education. All rights are returned to me, period, signed and dated, and you put it on the desk of the dean the day after. It will all stop. Because nobody will be willing to risk it anymore. They are living their best life of surveillance on the assumption that you will do nothing. And we shall see as we go that indeed constitutional law, as always, functions only for those who want it to. And you don't. You know you don't. You know you don't. But if we are to have constitutional order, if we are to have limits on state power set by the combined efforts of the people to free themselves, well, then I suppose Dan will be right. Yours will be the generation that makes the choice. When I lived in the Soviet Union, if KGB had possessed iPhones, first of all, there would never have been freedom of any kind for an instant. But secondly, if KGB had handed out surveillance devices all connected to the headquarters, and given them to people and said, please carry them. Many Russians would have done so, of course, just as you do now, but a number of Russians I knew would have tied them to dogs and sent them running through the street. Now, iPhones are, as you know, $1,000, $1,200, $1,400 in Moscow, and people give them to their 8-year-olds. The public memory, as that great American politician Richard Nixon said, is short. So we're going to try and lengthen it here, because of course constitutional law is always an exercise in memory. Questions? Gosh, I'm surprised. You'd think there would be one or two, wouldn't you? Well, at any rate, that means that there will be some empty spots in the room because a large number of people just decided I was too insane to listen to and there's no point in asking questions. And we'll just go on and pretend we didn't hear him until we can sidle away like from a drunk in a subway station. But I intend to be still here, as I have been since 1999. And then, of course, there's Edward Snowden. I did ask you to read what Mr. Snowden had to say and what I had to say about it long ago when, God, a decade, right? Think of that. A decade. He came, he prophesied, and everybody went to sleep on it. But then, of course, he was a traitor, not a prophet, you know. So, we have two jobs then, over the course of the next 13 weeks or so, assuming that the oxygen holds out. We have the job of understanding what it means to live in the presence of state power in these architectural circumstances. This affects us whether we are in the United States and are as American as apple pie or whether we are somewhere else and doing other things. This part of what we are reasoning about is largely independent of legal system. But a legal system that wishes to support the maintenance of human freedom under the conditions in which we find ourselves will have to concern itself with some fundamental operations which we hear about all the time, search and seizure, surveillance, national security, the principles of data mining, their power over control of democratic elections, the nature of misinformation, the pursuit of truth. We will be concerned with some of the same things that we have amendments in the United States Constitution made by the First Congress and called the Bill of Rights to consider. And so I propose to organize the conversation in some substantial measure by those terms. We will start, therefore, with Part 4 and consider the tragedy of search and seizure in this world of ours. And we will go from the tragedy of Part 4 to the comedy of Part 1. And I will try and show how the First Amendment and its particular approaches to the nature of free expression and the commitment to cultural pluralism work out in a world in which we are, well, obviously sustaining a somewhat parasitic distortion of the phrase freedom of speech, as you are aware. And then we'll think about Part 6 and 9 and 14, how we conduct justice in a world of pervasive spying and what it means to have a trial and rights of confrontation in the world of Zoom and what it means to consider the rights reserved to people. Here's your, here's your right to an abortion, but I can say here's your right to contraception. Maybe someday we get back the idea that human beings are allowed to control their own bodies, but really, in the network we are building, why should human beings control their own bodies? You don't control what you eat anymore. KFC messages you and offers you a discount 50 meters away at the time of day when you are, and by God, you're, and you know about the rest of it. That moment in Ex Machina when the poor schlub says to the Mark Zuckerberg of the day, did you make her face out of my porn profile? That's a good moment. Because, of course, that's happening to you all the time, too, now, right? Human appetites are what the parasite is powered by. And you all understand that the network now potentiates your appetites in ways that nobody could ever have done before. Never in the 5 million years we have been becoming ourselves was that possible before, but now it is. So the question then of how to organize the legal part of this conversation will turn out to be to organize it according to the ways in which the world we came from organized it. How we grew those rights and came to understand them over the course of time from the 18th century till now. I will indulge my other life as a legal historian, of course, because we can't really do constitutional law without doing constitutional history. I mean, it's done all the time in the course aptly called con law, but you couldn't really do it. So we'll do it, and we'll spend time on words and context and history and try and evolve an understanding both of what the substantive meanings of those freedoms were when human beings were the way they were when I was born, and what it means now that we are different, and yet we would like to believe that we are still free. The Emperor Augustus, as I pointed out in the first of the Snowden lectures, I hope you plowed through, the Emperor Augustus built the roads, created that communications network which held the empire together. Down those roads he sent his soldiers, but up those roads he learned what they learned at the other end and became the most informed person in the history of the world. Augustus, that subtle tyrant, said Gibbon, knew that mankind is ruled by words and that the people would accept their slavery if only they were assured that they had all their old liberties. Gibbon was right. Augustus was right. That's why we're here, because you think you're free. And as long as you are repetitively told that you live in the freest society on earth, in the freest market, with the most wonderful a-fucking-eye, and so on and so on, that's what you'll think. And thus you will accept what Augustus knew you would accept, which is tyranny, provided that it is subtle. And so the purpose of the merger between our technical understanding and our legal understanding is to interrogate precisely that process. I'm sorry that I have to go all left-wing in you and all, but once upon a time there was a man called Antonio Gramsci, and he sat in a prison, which is where all good leftists, after all, must eventually end up. And in his prison, he thought about the ability of power so to warp the very process of thinking that entire questions can be made to disappear. Those things which are the actual confrontational realities about power and society can be made to vanish in some mirage created in their place. I suppose he could just have sat at home and watched Mad Men from the couch and learned the same thing. But Gramsci gave it a name. He called it hegemony, that power to eliminate questions, to remove ideas, to displace entire fields of social confrontation. The Chinese Communist Party is a hegemonic party. That's its purpose. It has a theory of how to do it. So is Google. It has a theory of how to do it. But if we told you, we'd have to kill you. We're going then, in some sense, to be interrogating the basic question of constitutional law. Why does freedom exist at all? From the point of view of the owners, and they were owners, owners of property, owners of debt, owners of people, who collected themselves in 1787 in a hot summer in an already global warming environment in Philadelphia in order to make the Constitution, the question, why is there freedom, had an answer. An oddly, deeply ironic and tragic answer. There is freedom because there is slavery. We are the free people. And we see ourselves precisely in opposition to the idea of unfreedom, with which we are way better acquainted than we like to pretend. Hegemony, of course, is the meaning of that too, which is why the greatest of all historians of American slavery, Eugene Genovese, wrote in Roll, Jordan, Roll, one of the finest pieces of legal history ever written in the United States, and called it the hegemonic function of the law. Because that is the purpose of hegemony, to eliminate questions. Frederick Douglass said, as I hope I adequately reminded you in the second of the Snowden lectures, in his first memoir, at the moment when his mistress first taught him to read over the objections of her husband, who thought that slaves should never be taught to read because it makes them discontent and unhappy, Frederick Douglass said that the learning to read answered for him the question that he, as a super bright 8-year-old, had been asking himself all the way along. What is the secret of the white man's power over the black man? And the answer is, well, the knowledge of the question. Why is there freedom? Once the question was formed, well, and so I should state again a basic philosophic commitment so I don't have to keep saying it all the way along. Freedom begins in knowing that another future is possible. And the purpose of hegemony, the meaning of unfreedom, is to assert that no other future is possible. This is the way it is. And you know already how deeply the network in its relationship to you through the smart-ass phone that connects you to the parasite, you know how deeply it wants you all the time to believe as a technological reality that this is just the way it is. Which is why you use the technologies you use, and why they hurt you the way they hurt you, and why you are unconscious of the possibility that it could be different. Constitutional law, of course, is not about the difference. It's about the possibility of difference. It's not about what we actually do when we restrain the power of the state. It's about what we might do if the power of the state was restrained enough that we could be free to do what we want. To say what we want, to think what we want, to disobey orders when we want, to disappear from the structure of power when we want, to go away, to refuse, to deny, to obstruct, and to change social relationships from the way they are unto the way we want them, which is what our constitutional freedom is supposed to accomplish. But it cannot accomplish that for us if we do not know why we are seeking that, or what it is that we are trying to find. In the lives of your children's children, if the decisions that were made this generation are made against freedom, then the very idea of freedom will have perished. None of your grandchildren will know what it was like to be a human being in the middle of the 20th century when I was born. That will be an inaccessible experience to them. And if what happens in the course of your lifetime happens as it is intended to happen, as the parasite is manipulating you like rabies to make happen, then they will have no idea what freedom really was. Again, I wish to point out that the dominant political entity in the largest society on earth, well, for another 10 minutes anyway, wants that to occur, explicitly wants that to occur, is aiming for that to occur, and is currently using the largest manufacturing economy on earth to build what will be necessary in order to make it occur. On the other side, there's you and your smart ass phone. Don't worry, as one of Le Carré's characters said, Jesus only had 12 and one of them was a double. And so you are. You carry your double with you everywhere you go. It spies on you. It rats you out. If you were living in a place where fingernails are removed, it would do it for you. I have comrades who were tortured in Bahrain because they carried an iPhone to a demonstration. This isn't a theoretical proposition. Yours just hasn't done that to you yet. Good luck to you. Questions? Objections? Such a thing as a comment? Good heavens. Yes. Don't bother, it won't work. Just speak. Use the air molecules. Leave the parasite out of it for me. How do I know?
Well, I'm saying, it sounds like you're saying things change. I'm saying, if it's been like that since the Roman times, that maybe that's just a feature, not like a bug.
Well, it depends on how you feel about your own freedom. Doesn't it? I'm not prepared to consider my yearning for freedom to be a bug. I'm not prepared to consider my willingness for 700,000 human beings to die so slavery can die in the United States to be a bug. I think the man was right. We seek a new birth of freedom. That's what we're here for. I mean, in law school, right? But you're right, of course. If law is destined to fail at the project of freeing the human being, then what are you paying all the money for? Why am I still at it? Why did I spend my life like this? By the time the answer to the questions I am asking now is apparent to you in your life, I will be long dead. So it will be for you to figure out in the end whether you could beat the Romans or not. But let me just point out one last time that the Roman world is absolutely dependent upon slavery. It's inconceivable to understand at any level Roman power or the Roman economy or the nature of the ancient Mediterranean without taking slavery into account. The moment at which the Romans adopted slavery is the moment at which the Republic began to become the empire. So if it is always thus, then thus it always is, and I'm not for that. My work, my actual work as a lawyer, what I did all this time, was about making sure that didn't have to happen. That the technologies of freedom could compete successfully, indeed in superior ways, against the technologies of unfreedom. You can say, indeed, that we didn't succeed, but I'm going to try and show you why that story's not over yet. Melissa? Yeah.
I was curious about your KFC comment, which I know is maybe meant to be sort of one-off being lived, but I think it's...
No, it wasn't one-off being lived. It was just an observation about behavior in the market, which we've been doing in law school. Yeah. Not only the meal, the moment of appetite itself.
Yeah, like your mouth starts watering.
Okay, there we go. Yes, that Pavlov's dog. It's good for you.
But I'm wondering how much of that worldview is sort of just a discomfort with the fact that it was always kind of like that, and now you're just...
No, it wasn't always kind of like that.
It is, because...
I understand that it can be difficult to remember what you never saw, but that's not how I ate in law school. Oh, free will. I'm sorry. Yes, we'll have a thing or two to say about that. But of course, while we retain a constitutional perspective, we retain a sense of the individual, which it's difficult for us to give entirely away. You're right, of course, that if everything is dictated by deterministic forces, then whether the cop asks you whether he can search the car or not doesn't really matter. Whatever was going to happen was going to happen. But I got to tell you that, at least as a lawyer, I think it's really important to teach people to say, not without a warrant, sir. Right? There are moments, of course, of human agency, as we might prefer these days to call it. Free will is kind of out of style, but agency is big. There are moments of agency in a human life. They can be really important. Both of my parents died voluntary deaths. And when my time comes, so shall I. Not for the purpose of kicking the stone, thus I refute Berkeley, not in order to prove a philosophic point, but for sure as a last act of freedom. You can take that to the bank, right? And then, of course, you really have changed a little bit. You know, if you come to office hours, we'll probably sit around and have a conversation that often happens in office hours in my office for some reason. We'll talk about whether we can give up the smartphone. One afternoon, a few years back, we were having that conversation, and one person said, well, she said, I think I could give up the smartphone, but what if I were in a strange city and I got lost? And the anxiety started to bubble to the surface. And I said, well, you know, in the 20th century, we had a way of dealing with that called asking directions, and it still works. And then another young lawyer, an excellent one, one I deeply love and believe in, and who is out in the world doing good things, and he said, well, he said, I think I could do without the smartphone, but if I gave up the smartphone, how could I be a law student all day long and have anonymous sex every evening? And I said, no, you're right. Absolutely, you're right. We had no way of doing that. We had to just be law students. That's the difference, you understand. It's really an important one. Now, of course, the month after he said that, with enormous self-knowledge and vulnerability in a small room full of law students, try it sometime. The month after he said that, he met another person who was in his law school class, and they became a couple, and she made him delete the applications, and so it turned out that you don't worry about that anymore. Which is a free will of a kind, I suppose you could say. But the point is that to make yourself believe that all of the psychological phenomena of being you at the moment are just a continuation of what was there before the nervous system and the parasites, a mistake. It's a category error. It's a misunderstanding of what, I suppose, if I got all Derrida and shit on you, I could call the archaeology of human being. There's layers below that you've lost touch with. I wish I didn't have to say it as bluntly as that, but it's true. There's just a ton of shit you don't know. But we can find it. I'm just not sure that everybody wants to. you see. Yes.
So on this talk of, on this path to freedom, what is it that could stop freedom from becoming freedom from consequences?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. It's a good question. Because, of course, the very concept of freedom has been turned into license by some people. It's very hard to have this conversation in a Confucian context without getting that answer, without getting that return question. Now, the 18th century English-speaking people whose constitutional thinking we're going to start from, they knew the difference between liberty and license quite clearly, because that was a distinction which their vocabulary imposed on them. And my old friend, now departed, John Philip Reed, wrote an entire volume of the legal and constitutional history of the American Revolution about the 18th century way of thinking about the distinction between liberty and license. And you're right that government, particularly government of a certain kind, will always want us to be afraid of liberty lest it turn into license. And fear of disorder, fear of chaos, fear of the appetites and unregulated tendencies of the people around us is a powerful tool for holding people in mind. And the network does that now by making sure that you see every bloody body. You feel every act of aggression. You absorb the possibility that everything will spin out of control. And oddly, you begin to deprecate the idea of human liberty itself. Isn't it always like this? Aren't we always under control? Aren't we always fundamentally in the domination of the social around us? And if we weren't, wouldn't that turn into chaos overnight? I mean, what can one say? Yes, if you live that way, that's how it will feel to live. But we don't have to live that way. And so freedom isn't the license, it's the ability to conceive of the possibility of liberty that we might actually use for our common good, our common ability to be completely different from one another. That we might actually use our ability to think our own private thoughts to elevate the collective of us rather than to destroy it. Yes?
Will we ever agree on a common good?
I don't know, but if we do, it's probably very bad news. That is, after all, what a large part of the most dangerous politics in the world tries to do right now. The common good? Well, and oddly, in this neoliberal society of ours, in which we all are led in one way or another to believe that Mrs. Thatcher may have been right, that there's no such thing as society, it isn't our ability to agree on the common good which is our freedom. It's our ability to disagree about the common good and live together anyway, which is our freedom. And to say that we can find in the 18th century political tradition, which has given rise to what we have, the ability to have confidence in that is to be like Abraham Lincoln, desiring a new birth of freedom in the midst of a terrible war. I hope that's how you and I both come out, but I won't be here when your time comes, and so you'll have to figure out for yourself what you think then, and everything I have said here now will be nothing but mere prologue. That wasn't a riot, that was a peaceful demonstration in the middle of Pearl City in Bahrain. And the people who were tortured weren't tortured for being out of order. They were tortured for having an opinion. But yes, you're right, I did refer to it.
I was curious, do you know if there are any material differences between the privacy protections of Apple OS versus Android OS?
Sure, there are lots of them, but they're unimportant.
They're
degrees of triviality. If you're carrying a smart-ass phone, you're fucked, and that's your problem. You could do different things with your technology. You could use different software. You could use it in different ways. You could free yourself of most of that, and if you really wanted to break a sweat, you could break all of it. But that doesn't mean that we're going to wind up choosing consumer products. I'll show you how we might do it. I'll show you how I live if you care to know. I will explain to you that it's all possible, and then you'll decide it's not what you want, and you'll go back to wearing the collar again. But yeah, I can differentiate for you. I'm just not going to differentiate between the good form of the bad and the bad form of the bad. They're all made in Mordor. But that doesn't mean that everything has to be Mordor. No, the cameras are a problem that would have to be resolved at a level of tension between us and the university, which is inevitable. But the recording in your classes would cease, the leaking of information about your academic behavior, the leaking of enrollment information, a whole bunch of stuff you could stop by withdrawing consent and titrating upward their level of legal exposure. Then we would come up against some hard stuff. But we can deal with the hard stuff too, because we're lawyers. But you're right, that part of the reason that we have to be here and do this course is cops are harder than mere bullshit merchants. Right? But we could get the bullshit merchants out, and if we did that, and if you stopped lying on the bed scrolling hour after hour and throwing mental energy into your own captivation, then other things would suddenly be easier. It's the first blow that counts. Here I'm with Franz Fanon of the whatever else may be said about all that. You strike the first blow and you start becoming free. I'm sorry, that was a disappointing answer. What was it I didn't say?
No. I'm just wondering whether there would be an individual level to withdraw consent or whether you can do it.
Oh, the beginning of the individual withdrawal of consent would start an avalanche. Nobody thinks it's actually going to happen. Nobody sitting in this room thinks it's actually going to happen. I'm the only one who knows that if it happened, it would work, and therefore, it won't work. That's okay. I got time. That much time I have. Not much, but that much. I will live to see that. Or else, I might as well never have taught a class in the first place. 37 years down the drain. More? No, that was good. I mean, it was sort of good anyway. It's a bad first draft, the conversation we need to have. So, why do you have advertisements? I never have I used a computer that had advertisements. I never will. Why do you? Why is it okay? I'll make an argument here from personal authority of a kind I will never make again. I went to work making computer software in 1974 when I was 13, well, in 1972 when I was 13 years old. I made software all through my growing up. I made software in order to have the money to go to college. I made software to have the money to go to law school and to get a PhD in history. I made software. That was one of the things I did. I was a working man making software when I was not old enough to be a man. The first non-military application of digital computing occurred in the United States in 1946. When a machine called ENIAC was delivered to the National Bureau of Standards of the federal government, a year before John Bardeen and his colleagues created the transistor and made the technology of the digital world possible. When I went to work at the IBM Santa Teresa laboratory making software for mainframes, making computer languages for mainframes in particular, which was my specialty, in 1979, a week before I turned 20, my colleague in the next office, a man called Michael Montalbano, was working at the National Bureau of Standards in 1946 when the first non-military digital computer in the world came into existence. I am one degree of separation from the Big Bang. In the world in which I grew up, the idea that we would have advertisements in our computers, that somebody else would control the software for the purpose of coercing our attention or shaping our minds, was an unimaginable, ridiculous proposition. Even the science fiction on which we grew up, which was all about the Cold War, all about nuclear weapons, all about the unintended consequences of human technological invention, even the science fiction that we imagined, almost all of it, could not have imagined the obscenity of computing directed at advertising. Kurt Vonnegut could imagine it, but he had a particularly vicious imagination. But you accept. Accept, that would be a too soft a word. On the average, 2,000 advertisements a day in one study. 2,000. Why are they there? Why don't you get rid of them? Imagine what it would be like for you if your computing occurred with the same silence and respect for you than my computing does. If you had recovered the ability to shape your own time in relation to your technology, if the pace of your thought process and the functioning of your attention system were not constantly being destroyed by the parasite for the purpose of metabolizing your decreasing levels of attention, imagine that it simply wasn't there. Imagine that all that chatter went away. All that noise, all that running and jumping, all that bullshit, all that dancing on the corpse of what was your last thought process 5 seconds ago. Imagine that it simply ceased. How would you change? All I can say about it is that I wouldn't let what happens to you every day happen to me if it endangered my life. If you held a gun to my head and said, you die now or you live with advertising on your computer forever, I would say, yeah, you better pull the triggers up. Because my mind is valuable to me. I've spent almost 65 years building it. You let yours be pulled apart to shreds by, well, why? Is it because you think it couldn't be any other way? Is it because you think it would be inconvenient to have your mental integrity back? Is it because you think you might get lost or you might not get fucked enough? Or I don't think so. I don't think anybody told you, why don't you trade away the integrity of your consciousness for these trivial beads and fire water? I think you didn't know you didn't have to. That's unfreedom. The inability to imagine a different future or a different present or a different way of being human. But the minute we stop, the minute the air runs out in here and 30 minutes from now and everybody else staggers out barely capable of breathing, that's how you'll potentiate the anxiety that I was trying to raise in you for an hour and 20 minutes. You think, oh, and you'll feel soothed. Because your sense of psychic equilibrium is already located outside yourself. It's already been externalized. And when it was externalized, the parasite infected it. And here you are, the new human. One advertisement at a time, at a time, at a time, at a time. How many clicks? How many swipes? Every time you do that, you're teaching the machine. The machine's not teaching you. You don't even know what's happening. It's obscure to you. But it changes you moment by moment. And state power? In 1985, I'm sorry, in 2005, Steven Spielberg was thinking about adapting a Philip K. Dick novella back to the science fiction of our childhoods. And so in making Minority Report, he went and talked to a lot of smart people in my world, trying to figure out what it would mean to dramatize in the reality of then, imagining the reality of now, the consequences for human beings of another way of connecting to one another. And if you look at Minority Report, you will see again the extraordinary insight with which Spielberg came away from that educational process to the part of art making. Embedded in the art he made is a fundamental proposition about the history of this, namely that commercial surveillance comes first and government power follows after. This wasn't the way in which most of the science fiction of our childhoods understood things, because, as I say, it was the fiction of the Cold War and the nuclear arms race, and it assumed that the state led first, possessing rockets and missiles and bombs and all of that. But Spielberg adapting Philip Dick was correct in dramatizing the reality, which is that in the world of capitalism, commercial surveillance comes first and government comes after. Here, in this particular free market paradise of ours, you can see pretty well the fulfillment of the firmness and extent of commercial surveillance. And right before your eyes, the other shoe is dropping. If you live 13 time zones west or east of here, whatever you call it, on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, the state has already fully engaged. The perfection of despotism is the goal, and the market is merely one of its tools. If you live in Europe, of course, it's just heaven. But that's because there's no state of denial like the European state of denial. So we confront the problem already aware that we've had one drink too many and it's all a little woozy now. And of course, we don't know shit about technology. We use stuff all the time that we completely don't understand. And when I mean we don't understand it, I mean if we wanted to understand it, we couldn't, because we couldn't read the source code, because it's not available to us, because we can't modify it, because we can't change it, because if we change it in a way which is good for us and it would be good for somebody else, we can't share, because that would be against the law. That's why the relationship between law, software, and power is so intimate, and why the work I have mostly done in most of my life was to make the software free as in freedom, to build technologies of freedom collaboratively together, and to share them with one another, and to clear the law out of the way so that private power in the market and public power in the state couldn't interfere. What if there were no strong encryption? I know you live mostly as though there were no strong encryption, but you're dependent as hell on the fact that what you say in WhatsApp isn't being sent directly to the cops. And that requires Zuckerberg to have acquired free software encryption technology from my comrade Moxie Marlinspike at Signal, and that requires the law to permit people to build stuff like what Moxie builds, and that requires us not to put in jail people who make encryption software that can be used in the outside world, and that requires a legal victory against the attempt of the United States government to put a man in jail for making strong encryption that everybody can use, and that's my life from 1990 to 1999, and because Philip Zimmerman didn't go to jail, you are allowed to have a secret. And if we hadn't done that work, you'd have no secret, and everybody would be transparent to all power everywhere, and you would live in hell already. So it will turn out that the details matter, and we'll spend time on details, technical details, legal details, because it's made, these chains of yours. They're made of little links, all of which can be broken, but you don't break them because you don't know that they're there. My comrade William Blake is right. He says, everywhere he goes, I hear mind-forged manacles clanking. And he was right, but we have better ones now, God knows. Mind-forged manacles, yes indeed. That's how it is. Questions? Comments? Yes. Good.
What do you think about the opportunity that allows like individuals, like entrepreneurial individuals, to like, I guess, capitalizing on an already pervasive system?
But nothing has to be only bad or only good. We are, after all, lawyers. You and I know that being lawyers, we are never far from evil. So you're right, of course. The freedom that people have to buy and sell and to go into debt is a very powerful freedom. Of course, the minute they actually start buying and selling and going into debt, it turns out that it's not quite as free as it looked. And you're right, of course, that entrepreneurs are wonderful and innovation is wonderful. But here's the thing. One day, I was younger then and still optimistic about my own capacities, I woke up from a deep sleep and I thought, man, you are really, really brilliant. You are so totally brilliant that you have figured out something really important while you were asleep. Because while I was asleep, I had realized why it was that capitalism creates inevitably inferior technology. See, of course, the profit motive isn't always on the side of technological perfection. And every time in capitalism that there's a conflict between profit motive and technological sophistication, profit wins. And so over time, an enormous technical debt builds up between what we could have done and what we did because the profit motive made us do something less good but more money-making for somebody. And I was just so pleased with myself. Oh my God, I'm so smart. A couple of months later, I was reading the letters of Rosa Luxemburg. And in late 26, just before they came and murdered her and threw her body in the Spree, Rosa Luxemburg writes in a letter, she says, you know, capitalism produces inherently inferior technology. Because every time the profit motive and technological sophistication diverge, capitalism has to choose the profit motive, and therefore over time we build up an enormous gap between the technology we could have had and what capitalism gave us, and therefore when we have socialism, we will have technology better than anybody's ever seen. And it restored my sense of humility, and it restored my sense of sorrow that they murdered her and threw her body in the river. And it reminded me that that's what tends to happen when you're really, really smart, smarter than I am. But my ambition is to be that smart. Therefore, well, you know. But you're right, of course. In the meantime, you and I could make some money in business together. I've got some ideas that would make great apps. I'm sure you do too. Right? Is that what you mean, Lon? That's what I think. I mean, I'm pretty sure. I've watched it happen once or twice. I never ended up in the river myself, but as I say, some of my comrades are there.
I'm struggling to think of like a scenario where the technology would give a better profit margin if it's worse than...
Oh my God, you've never used Microsoft Windows? You don't understand what the king of the undead now did when he built these things that everybody's using? You have no idea how bad that technology is. None. Really, none. Truly. I mean, this is why the details matter so much. I will not touch things made by the king of the undead now. I will not physically touch them. I have touched one object made by the king of the undead once on the day after my mother died because of a phone call among my brothers and somebody handed me an iPhone. I will not otherwise physically contact them because you know how it is with the ring. It weighs heavy in your hand. You put it around your neck and then you can't give it up. Bad technology can be very, very habit forming. The king of the undead now dead was a moral monster, but he was the greatest artist of the second half of the 20th century. And his purpose, like the art of the evil, is to make the evil beautiful, and he did. The beauty of his technology is not its superiority. The beauty of his technology is the nature of the evil. but you don't care. The stuff that they make is 10 times more costly than it's worth. And you pay it anyway because of the beauty of it, because it's jewelry for the intellectual class. That's how it could happen. Microsoft Windows is a degenerate version of X Windows made 10 years after we did it right, to do it wrong, purposely to do it wrong, to dumb it down, to make people feel their superiority to a technology which produced the blue screen of death and lost their... Bad quality is never a problem for a monopoly, right? Well, that's how it could happen, isn't it? Monopolies can make a lot of money reducing output, reducing innovation, and reducing quality. Why are you surprised? It's not as though the Ec 101 of this is difficult. Every microeconomics course that ever taught the theory of the firm taught that. You just made an exception in your mind because it looked so cool. But it doesn't look cool if you're good at it. It only looks cool if you've never done a cool thing with software yourself. If you have, trust me, it's not impressive. Is that an answer or did I miss the... No, okay. Anybody else? That's easy. It's just software. In a digital medium, digital media are filterable. Removing advertising is a matter of filtering. You want to get 80% of it out of your life right now in 5 minutes? Download Brave and use that browser instead of one made by an advertising company. You want to go a little further? That's fine. One little piece of software, maybe it fucks with your DNS, but don't use Android because it won't let you. Or maybe it's Privoxy and you've got a thing between you and the web stream whose only job is to get rid of advertising coming in and destroy your leakage of information going out. Maybe you have a little box of mine called a Freedom Box, some $75 single board computer whose only job in life is to sit there and do that for you. It's not hard. I'm not breaking a sweat about it. It's true that my software was there before the avalanche, but that's okay. I can melt as much snow as they can make because it's digital. There's no friction in it. The simplicity of freeing yourself from that is the easiest part of the simplicity. Then when we start to ask ourselves how to get the state listeners off your back, it gets a little harder. When we ask ourselves how to keep Columbia from selling your email to people, it gets a little harder. When we actually come up against, but the advertising? You have the most to gain from the lowest hanging fruit. Let's say that that's the outcome of the conversation you and I are presently having. The 80% of it would change your life. The 20% of it is hard. And if you live in the wrong place and you do the wrong things, that 20% will get you tortured and killed. But at least you won't have to listen to all that shit while they torture you.
Did you say that there are any benefits,
why are you watching YouTube? You just, I mean, you know, back in my time, when I was getting out of law school, we had an idea that cocaine is God's way of telling you you have too much money. YouTube is God's way of telling you you have way too much fucking time on your hands. Right? Its job is to steal your attention. Why are you letting it? Oh, but you don't want to pay for it. Well, I totally agree with you. You should not pay for stuff that rots your brain. But let's make your personal budget of stuff I pay to watch to have my brain rotted, okay? And that's going to be big. You pay a lot of money to rot your brain.
But I also want to say something rotted. Like I'll throw out that probably saved a lot of people in classes and things like that.
You think? Yeah. Why? Well, see, I have this odd idea that if I were a head in a box, I wouldn't be as good a teacher. It's actually important for me to be here, for us to talk to one another. You want to know whether I think the history of the last 5 years proved that or not? Yeah, I think that proved it. What happened to us during the epidemic was we went up against that idea, and boy, it was bad for everybody. Think of those children. Yeah. I get it. You can give reasons why it's good. This the beginning of that was what I think of as commercial narcissism, right? If I'm getting what I want, then it must be good. And I'm getting the advertisements for what I want, and therefore... And you're right, of course, in some level. It's better than being shown pictures of people doing terrible things to innocent children all the time. But you watch those too on YouTube now. And probably you feel compelled to, because it's hard to turn your head away from war. And so we marinate in it. And we think we're getting just what we want, because if we don't want it, we can click to go to the other channel. And there's a billion channels. But seen from the perspective of the distant past or the distant future, it doesn't look so good anymore. The way that was being human right now, it's not going to be on the all-time greatest hits list of ways to be human. But you're right, we're getting what we want.
I mean, these are bad things. Well, the point is, it seems like,
oh, but I use more computers than you do all day long. I run a 40-node private cloud. I have a whole bunch more computing than you have, and every day I do things with computers you have no idea are possible. I'm not against the technology. I'm against unfreedom. And you're right. I have to fess up. It's radical. You caught me. What do you want to do? You want to have a face and a voice? You want to talk in a... Well, that's fine. So you'll figure it out. If you really say to me, here's an engineering problem. Here are these people. This is what they have. This is what they know how to do. This is what they can be taught to do. Let's give ourselves one secure communications channel. I say, fine. No big deal.
But with today's technology, without developing something new, what would you say is the best way to communicate? Would you use an app like Telegram? You don't have a smartphone?
No, I personally don't want to use Telegram, because in order to be using Telegram, I'd have to be using a smart-ass phone. But it's not a problem. I mean, I run a Jitsi Meet server. You can have secure video conferences with anybody in the world you want anytime. You could use my hardware to do it, because my hardware won't rat you out. But you could run a thing yourself in a box that again, will fit in your palm and cost you $75 and will give you the equivalent of Zoom, except no Chinese Ministry of State Security and no American NSA. And if you wanted to do that, they wouldn't need anything except a browser on any device in the world. You're wrong to think it's complicated. It isn't complicated. You're right to think that nobody wants to teach you. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be done. Of course it can be done. Now, if they are located inside the PRC, we're going to have to get fancy, because state power is busy all the time trying to find out who's trying to do that so they can hurt them. But even so. Though I should mention that I had two comrades in Beijing working on exactly what you want 5 years ago. And they vanished. And after a while, a friend of a friend of a friend of one of their wives said to me, you know, we will never even find their ashes. So, of course, I have to ask about where the people are, and whether they are Han or not Han, or maybe Uyghur. Or, you know, I mean, we have to adapt ourselves to the fact that we are very far down this road already. But there's almost no place on earth where the situation is so bad that I can't figure out a way to help you. And you will discover that there are tens of thousands of people who've been trying to do that, and none of them made Telegram. And if I'm KGB, oh, pardon me, SVR, I love Telegram. I love Telegram. If Tsar Vladimir wanted Telegram not to exist, it would not exist tomorrow. Therefore, Tsar Vladimir wants Telegram to exist. Therefore, you shouldn't be caught dead there. Yes?
I'm wondering if it's the same struggle as anti-capitalism, is it a separate struggle?
I don't know. I mean, not from my point of view is it the same struggle. But I can certainly see how people could make that happen if they wanted to. I wanted something else. I wanted to change the global software industry in order to make freedom happen everywhere at capitalism's expense. That meant I needed companies like IBM to spend billions of dollars making that occur. That meant I needed people as bad as Larry Ellison to want to make that happen. So I found a way to make them want that. I can write on my tombstone, if my death is now, I can write on my tombstone with total confidence what I have planned to put there for years. He got more money out of Larry Ellison than any anarchist who ever lived, which I did. You could have any orientation you want towards those questions, because the greatest problem for the human race isn't capitalism. The greatest problem for the human race is the parasite. Now, parasite and capitalism, they live together fine, white on rice. Money always marries power, and you can't stop the wedding. But capitalism is a symptom. A symptom of the ungovernable human appetite for infinite growth. Max Weber was correct that it would not have been possible culturally in the Europe of the 17th century to have given a moral consistency to the appetite for unlimited growth without Calvinism. That was ultimately the point about the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, that it produced a morality within which the logic of ultimately endless growth, and as my dear friend, now departed David Graeber, pointed out in Debt, the first 5,000 years, capitalism was not the first such system. Mahayana Buddhism was, which also had an ethic of unlimited growth, because the Dharma could never be complete anywhere until it was complete everywhere, which meant the entire world had to adopt the Mahayana way. And if you ask about the history of capital and markets in China, you will discover the importance of that. And if you ask why, well, I mean, maybe you don't ask. I was once upon a time sitting in Shenzhen having a conversation with a bunch of lawyers who worked for Huawei. Therefore, they were women, because as a Huawei executive once said to me, in our company, boys are engineers and girls are customer service agents and lawyers. So we and the lawyers, we were sitting in an American restaurant in Shenzhen, utterly inedible but very cool. And one of the lawyers says to me, so, she says, you're a communist. Yes, I said, I'm the only communist in China. And then she looked at me another couple of minutes, and she said, indeed, what needed to be said next, unquestionably, she said, and you're a Jew. And I said, yes, that's right. And the Han and the Jews, we have known one another for thousands of years and done business across the way. And it's weird how we always recognize one another. And then we fell to the discussion of the question, the first koan, the greatest of all Buddha questions, why did the Bodhisattva go from India into China? And they explained to me the answer that they had been taught in Chinese school, which was that the Bodhisattva never went from India into China because the Buddha was born in India. Now, I think this was actually a technical discussion about who owns that little piece of Nepal, you know, about which. But it was a terribly important moment, because I realized that the Chinese Communist Party had the greatest Buddha wisdom I had ever run into. Because when asked the fundamental question, the first koan, why did the Bodhisattva go from India into China, they gave the true Buddhist answer, because he was never in India. It's funny to think that that could produce a lust for uninhibited, endless growth, as deteriorative human nature as capitalism itself, and yet it can, because ideas are always capable of being turned in any direction through the freedom of human thought. Yes. Well, I mean, the alliance between human beings and the parasite, our desire to keep feeding it and growing it and making money off it, yes, exactly. Exactly. Total information awareness is what the American government calls it. Efficient innovation is what Google calls it. I don't know what OpenAI calls it, and I don't care. Okay, all that shifting around is right. It's time to go. It's all done. Back to normal programming. All will be as it usually is. See you in a week.